Hello, everybody, and welcome to this evening's discussion of literature in the 21st century. Welcome also to the launch of the University of Manchester's Centre for New Writing. My name is Ian Maguire, and with John McAuliffe, I'm co-director of the centre. In just a moment, I'll hand you over to Professor Alistair Ulf, Dean of the Faculty of Humanities, who's going to do offer a more formal welcome. But I just wanted to take a minute of your time to say a few thanks, because on an occasion like this, obviously there are many people to whom we owe a debt of gratitude. I'm not going to thank everybody, but just a few people. First of all, from the university, Alan Gilbert, the president, who couldn't be here today, Alistair Ulf, Graham Ward, who's head of the School of Arts, Histories and Cultures, and David Alderson, who till recently was head of English American Studies. All those people have been hugely helpful in setting up the centre, and without their effort and energy and ambition, we wouldn't be here today. Another person who I think we all should thank is Joe Nightingale, who's responsible for events and media relations at the centre, and she has almost single-handedly arranged this evening, so thanks to her. And I'd also like, on a more personal note, to thank John McAuliffe as well, my co-director, who has been hugely important and influential in moving creative writing in Manchester to where it is today. Okay, so I'll just hand over now to Alistair Ulf.
Okay, thank you, Ian. As Vice President of the University of Manchester and Dean of the Faculty of Humanities, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here to this first public event to mark the launch of the Centre for New Writing and the appointment of Martin Amis as Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Manchester. This is the third major new initiative launched by the Faculty of Humanities in the last 2 years, involving the creation of a new research centre associated with the appointment of an iconic figure as a professor at the University of Manchester. The first was the Brooks World Poverty Institute, with the appointment of Professor Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize for Economics. The second was the Harvard-Manchester Initiative on Social Change, with the appointment of Professor Robert Putnam from Harvard, best known for his work on social capital. Creative writing courses have been taught at the University of Manchester for over a decade, with a rapidly growing number of staff and students, and an impressive record of published work by our alumni. The Centre for New Writing will build on this experience to create a hub where the best and most interesting contemporary literature is both written and written about. We aim to attract the most talented writers, staff, and students to the centre. The appointment of Professor Martin Amis illustrates this ambition. And highly respected writers, such as the Booker-nominated novelist M.J. Hyland and prize-winning poet Fiona Gruer, who are here this evening, are visiting the centre. We've already recruited a record number of MA and PhD creative writing students to the centre. But the centre will reach out beyond the university by hosting public events with all of its visiting writers, including its Literature Live series of readings and discussions, and 4 events each year with Professor Amis. Details of this season's events can be seen in the bookmarks on your seats. Like the Brooks World Poverty Institute and the Harvard-Manchester Initiative on Social Change, the centre will also be running an annual summer school aimed at attracting talented students from around the world to study in Manchester. More generally, the importance of the Centre for New Writing to the wider literary community will be marked by launching in 2008 a new online magazine, the Manchester Review. As I've said, this evening's event is the first public event to mark the launch of the Centre for New Writing and the start of Professor Amis's career as a university teacher. since the day he gave his first student seminar. Tonight's event takes the form of a debate between Martin Amis and two other eminent contemporary writers, John Banville and Will Self, on the state, role, and future of literature in the 21st century. And I'd like to thank John Banville and Will Self for joining us this evening. Some of you may have seen a short preview of this debate with a discussion between Martin and John Banville on the Newsnight program last Thursday. And this evening's debate will be chaired by our answer to Jeremy Paxman, Dr. Payne Mitchell from the Center for New Writing. So I'd like to, again, thank you very much for coming to this event. I very much hope you enjoy this evening's event. And I'd like to hand back now to Ian McGuire.
Thanks, Alistair. Okay, so we won't hang around for much longer. I just wanted to introduce our panelists in a little bit more detail. They're so well-known and distinguished that to list their achievements would take half the evening, so I won't do that. I'll just introduce them each very briefly, and then we'll get on with the main business of the evening. So Martin first. Martin Amis is one of the most well-known novelists of our time, and certainly one of the most important and influential English novelists of the last 30 years. Drawing inspiration from the great American novelists of the 20th century, Nabokov and Bellow in particular, Martin has consistently produced writing which in both in style and subject matter has been uniquely innovative and ambitious. He's also a writer, as this evening's event testifies, who's very interested in engaging in public debates and on matters of cultural and political importance. And his most recent work, or some of his most recent work, has engaged with the cultural aftermath of 9/11. John Banville, who joins us as well tonight, is a much acclaimed and multi-prize winning Irish novelist whose body of work since the early 1970s has, amongst its many notable qualities, been remarkable for an allegiance expressed via style and theme to the values of high art and to the ideal of the novel at its best as an art form comparable in subtlety and depth to poetry, philosophy, and music. John has won the James Tate Black Memorial Prize, the Guardian Fiction Prize, and in 2005, the Man Booker Prize for his novel, The Sea. And our third member of the panel is Will Self. Since 1991, with the publication of Will's first volume of short stories, The Quantity Theory of Insanity, Will has produced a string of novels and story collections of dazzling originality and inventiveness. Drawing his inspiration from writers such as J.G. Ballard, William Burroughs, and Alistair Gray, Will creates strange and distorted fictional worlds which echo, parody, and in some way undermine our own. He is, of course, also very well known and respected as a journalist, as currently has a column in The Independent. As Alistair said, today's discussion is moderated by Kay Mitchell, who has recently joined us at the Centre for New Writing. Kay is a specialist in contemporary writing, and her most recent work was a full-length study of the novelist A.L. Kennedy. Okay, so I'll hand us over to Kay and let battle commence.
Yes, I'm slightly distressed by being described as the centre's answer to Jeremy Paxman. I won't be asking the same question 17 times, just so that everyone's aware of that. The title of our discussion tonight is Writing in the 21st Century, and obviously that invites a reflection on the recent past of literature. What has literature been doing in recent years? Also, on the present, what is the state of literature now? Is it in a good state? What's the function or the role of literature within our society? It also asks us, I think, to speculate a little bit on what the future of literature might be, to be prescient, to think ahead. And it asked us, in doing that, I think, to reflect on the forms and styles of literature, the ways in which they have evolved in recent years. Also on the subject matter. There's been quite a lot of discussion in recent years about whether or not we've returned to questions of history and politics, whether literature has acquired a new seriousness, almost a moral seriousness in some ways. And tonight, I think, there will also be some room for discussion of the literary industry more generally, because of course literature doesn't occur in a vacuum. It is a commodity there is a marketplace to which it does or doesn't cater, something which all three of these authors are very aware of. So I'm going to start out really by just asking each of them, and Martin, if I can start with you, to think about what you think the recent and the significant evolutions in literature have been, perhaps particularly in the novel.
Right. Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming again. I echo Alistair in welcoming you. I'd like to begin with a bold statement that much follows from this, and it is that the relationship between the writer and the reader is a love relationship based on love, and I'll return to that in a little while. But first let me say that writers now are if I can put it this way, are within history, are inside history in a way they haven't been before. For instance, the idea that the planet was a finite commodity would have had no resonance for a resident of the 17th century England any more than it would have done to the dog at his feet. Similarly, the idea of being inside various historical, geohistorical processes is new and peculiar, I think, to our time. If you want to know what's going to happen, you know, if you want the tactical as opposed to the strategic view of what's happening in fiction, you could do worse than read some poor dab or miserable bleeder, depending on your point of view, who reviews modern fiction practically for a living. I don't know if the poor dab was a miserable bleeder all along, but they sure are after they've been doing that for a couple of years. And you can get some sense of where the novel is going by listening to the complaints of such a reviewer when they say things like, why are there so many novels about... Or, can we please have a moratorium on novels about... they've been saying that recently about science. Can we please have fewer novels about science? And it's true that I think in the coming decades, writers, novelists, poets will, in some sense, be philosophers of science. Einstein always kept up with philosophy of science. He wanted to know what the moral implications of his own discoveries meant, what they were, and he read the philosophy of science to find out. But no scientist today has anything but contempt for philosophy of science. It's still done, but they don't read it. Science is out on its own, and I think the novelist will fill that void. There's nothing to be done about that. The other thing they'll say, why, and can we have a moratorium on, is terror. They don't want, they get sick of novelists writing about this. Again, it's a bit like complaining about the inevitable, because politics in the last 6 years has come to fill the sky. Norman Mailer said the temptation was to rush in on September the 12th, but he said, and we all agree, that it takes several years for public events to filter down into the unconscious, and that's where novels come from. You can't do it from the top of your head, from the frontal brain. It has to go right through your system and come out the other side. The other thing, when they've got a way of identifying it that people are going to complain about the frequency of, is novels about the market state. This is a peculiar new phenomenon that we're living within. And its implications are not just economic, in that individuality now is more prominent a force or an idea than at any other time in human history. Government has stepped back in the model of the market state, and its only function is to encourage, to make possible opportunities for the individual, and the media has moved into several areas that used to belong to government, does much of the work that Parliament used to do, checking the executive. It solves crimes, it does quality control, it is ecological watchdog. And with a swollen media, individuality again is, that's like, encourages its growth. The fourth thing that regular novel reviewers are going to start complaining about very soon are novels about global warming. One can understand that in a way. I mean, when you've reviewed your fifth novel, Running, that begins with this sentence, heaving a heavy sigh and scratching his nose, Splork led the camel out of the igloo and faced and looked out at the conflagration that was heading towards him. But, you know, this subject, global warming, has gone. Is it just me, or has it gone in the last 3 weeks from being something that we're not sure is going to happen to something that is upon us even as we speak? And things that we've been thinking about and writing about for over a couple of years turn out to be to do with this, like the war in Darfur, which is a warming war, a water war, as the arable land contracts. So I'm afraid the fiction review is going to have to get used to a bit more of that. What I want to say is that fiction is not a series of bandwagons that novelists, these alert opportunists, leap onto as they trundle past. It's a very deep process. When I said writing is about love, I mean it from the point of view of the reader. One of the reasons why the book itself will never die is that we get attached to books as we get attached to self-communion in our adolescence, when we suddenly realize that there is someone within your own self to communicate with, and you begin to do it with notes and diaries and poems. And the writers that move you, you feel when you finish a novel, your desire is to contact them, to write to them, even though they may have been dead for centuries. It's also a love relationship from the point of view of the writer. and we can see what happens when that goes wrong in the case of two of our greatest novelists, James Joyce and Henry James, where love for the reader simply gives out. So in the case of Joyce, you have that noble, all-inclusive book, Ulysses, followed by that 700-page crossword clue, Finnegan's Wake. You know, we all agree there are a couple of things that novels can't do. One is sex, one is dreams. To write 700 pages about dreams in the form of multilingual puns is not the act of a lover. It's the act of an invert. In James's case, you see this generous intelligence, this thriving marriage with the reader devolve into separate beds and then separate rooms, and then messy divorce. And late James, the relationship is not between the writer and the reader, it's between the sentences. The sentences are having a relationship with themselves. Now, just to end, fiction is as complex and multiform as social change and as history itself. These great churnings, the relentless unforeseen, no one knows how fiction is going to respond, but it will, and as inevitably as history unfolds. The difference is, although Kafka said that every novel should have the weight of a death in the family, which I think was a joke. He's a very funny writer, and I think he was pointing to the fact that it never can have that weight, and we should be glad of that, because writing is a place where there are no injuries or deaths, or no one gets hurt. It is Edenic. It's in an unfallen world, funnily enough. And writing takes place in that garden where the lion lies down with the lamb and the rose grows without thorn. Thank you.
So it's simultaneously quite idealistic and slightly cynical view of literature. I think interesting. which does make me want to ask you, do you love the reader, Martin Angus?
about the reader.
And to what extent are you responding to those concerns with science and politics and that new relationship to history that you're talking about? Do you see yourself as doing that?
Well, yes, but it's not a conscious decision. It's generally agreed that writing is a fairly mysterious business, but the more you do it, the more you realize that it's a very mysterious business, and you don't know how your response is going to form and how your response is going to evolve. Evolution is the word. I mean, it's a truism that writing does not improve. It evolves and provides the model. You hope that your love of the reader, by the way, which is not any desire to have yourself loved by the reader, is to have your work loved, your words loved, and that's the impulse. But you hope that, love is a talent like any other, and you hope that it survives the passing of time.
As Martin started us off with these questions of politics and particular preoccupations with science, religion, we could add terror, you mentioned. One of the things we've seen in recent years with literature, I think, is that increasingly fiction has had to compete with non-fiction, which is very widely reviewed, very much pushed by publishers. And there's been a rise in that kind of quirky non-fiction, I think particularly since the publication of Longitude, some years ago now. I'm interested in the extent to which all three of you feel that you are dealing with non-fictional concerns in your fiction and with sort of current preoccupations. John Bamvill, I know you've a couple of your books have been based on real-life events, The Book of Evidence, The Untouchable as well. Do you draw a kind of distinction between non-fictional writing and fictional?
Yes, a long time ago, while you were still in your cradle, I wrote a couple of books dealing with scientists, Copernicus and Kepler. And I sort of gave up in despair because I felt that it simply couldn't be done. There was something to do with trying to mesh science with fiction. That didn't work. I couldn't do it. I always felt that the bits of facts, if you had to put a scientific theory into fiction, it stood out like a bleeding piece of meat. And I essentially gave that up. I think that it depends what you want the novel to do, or what you expect the novel to do. Henry James, whom Martin has mentioned, one of the direct inspirations for The Portrait of a Lady was his reading of Middlemarch, and his famous description of that book as a loose, baggy monster. There are many critics and there are many readers, and I think it's a tenable argument, who would argue that the novel should be a loose, baggy monster, that it should be this capacious portmanteau that you can pour anything into, and that the form is so amorphous that it will absorb anything that you pour into it. But if you want to do a different kind of novel, and the House of Fiction has many mansions, if you want to do a different kind of novel, then you have to work in a different way. W.H. Auden said about the poem that it's the only art form that you either take or leave. You can look at a picture and think about sex, or you can listen to music and think about what you're having for dinner. But a poem you either read or you don't read. If you want to make fiction that has the same demands upon the reader, then you have to work in a different way. And you can't really be concerned with the great world other than as material. This is to work, I suppose, narrowly. And yet, I think that some of the people, at least, whom Martin greatly admires, like Nabokov, would have said, this is the way to do fiction. I've always been fascinated by Martin's work in that he has these two sides to him. It was mentioned earlier that there's Bellow on one side and there's Nabokov on the other. You could not get two different artists. And Martin has tried to, throughout his career, to find a kind of a melding between those two. It creates very, very interesting fiction which I think has not reached its destination yet. So It depends what you want to do. Do you want to make a kind of poetry? Do you want to have an art that looks at the world and says, Shakespeare's sonnet says, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea whose action is no stronger than a flower? A very dainty conceit on the part of the hard-headed Shakespeare, but yet one that haunts me. How, in the face of the great world, and the great incoherent, chaotic world, how does art make objects that are absolutely beautiful and that will live through the ages? Because this is what we want to do. Martin talks about the love affair with the reader. The love affair with the reader is also the love affair with the book itself, with the object. One wants to fashion these absolutely permanent things, as permanent as our little world can be. So how do you deal with the present moment, which is the stuff of fiction, has to be the stuff of fiction? We can only write about human life. Joyce tried to get outside it, Flaubert tried to get outside. It can't be done, as we saw, as Martin rightly said. Finnegan's Wake is a great, great disaster, and I would put equal emphasis on both words, great and disaster. As T.S. Eliot memorably said about Finnegan's Wake, I wish I could do his accent. One book like this is enough. And that's true, but we have to keep trying to achieve that poetically fashioned object. And it's one of the interesting things about being a fiction writer rather than a poet or a philosopher or anything else.
So in that sense, you're suggesting that your own work comes out of that desire to fashion a beautiful object, and which is a kind of universal concern, or a desire for universality, perhaps, but within the frame of the particular.
Yes, I mean, Martin and I have known each other off and on for a long time. We admire each other's work, but I think that we, in some ways, are diametrically opposed. He's quoted Kafka. The motto that I take from Kafka is that wonderful thing that he said in one of the diary entries: the artist is a man who has nothing to say. So, play with that one.
Okay, yes, that might be inauspicious. Will Self, are you the artist who has nothing to say? How do you approach writing? Is it a way that similarly is to do with this love of the reader, with a concern to fashion a beautiful object, to make poetry, to respond to the current, to political issues, or...?
Nothing to say.
None of the above. So you are the artist.
I hate the reader.
It's very honest.
I like to give the reader a bit of a slap. Better not come round my house, because you won't be welcome. I hate the reader. I love the reader. I want to have sex with the reader. I want to stroke the reader, I want to pummel the reader, I want to tread on the reader's instep quite hard, and I want to embarrass the reader, cajole the reader. I think John once sent me a note because I'd said on a radio program that I only really wrote for myself, which engendered a sort of chorus of disapproval from somewhere, but I think, you know, to follow on, I think it's interesting that already that the kind of direction this conversation is taking, because, I mean, for me, you know, the novel is a kind of pre-technological chat room in which you encounter another psyche shorn of sexual identity or race or class or gender or, you know, anything like that. It's a very pure form of contact, and I write for exactly the person who wants to read what I write. It's a tautology, and, you know, I don't like or love myself the whole time, so why on earth would I like or love my readers the whole time? It would be rather sort of cloying, it seems to me. And I slightly take issue with the assumed centrality of the novel in our culture. It seems to me that the centrality of the novel to Western culture is to do with a definable historical epoch and period. And it's interesting that already the names that are being mentioned and the sense of periodicity, the stratigraphy of the novel that's being exposed here very rapidly points to its relationship with industrialization, its relationship to an aspirational culture of the late 19th century that placed the book and the novel and the reading of the novel. It's very interesting the names that have come up already in connection with this. That is not true of our society. Nobody is going to be reading The Mill on the Floss or then fast-forwarding and reading Tono Bungay and then fast-forwarding a little bit and reading Ulysses and then not reading Finnegan's Wake because they think they're participating in this very, very, very central discourse that the novel represents. So I don't really think it holds that position in our culture anymore, and I think that there is, to be blunt, a kind of academicized perspective about it that is understandable in people who spend their professional lives in university departments about what the novel might mean in contemporary society. It seems to me, or in contemporary culture, that it's a much more fragmented and variegated picture. There is no, you know, much as the kind of a certain stratum of the predominantly white bourgeoisie in this country might like to point to one or other writer as occupying the position once held by these kind of late 19th century and maybe early 20th century luminaries, I don't think it really obtains if you look at the culture as a whole. I don't think that novelists are competing with each other. I think they're competing with a pop song that's being played on a BlackBerry. I think that, you know, not even film has lost its position as a dominant cultural narrative medium, let alone the novel. See? I bet you wish I hadn't said anything now.
But no one was saying it was central.
No?
No. I was saying no one has claimed centrality for the novel. Just permanence, not centrality.
Well, I take issue with permanence as well. I mean, posterity, you know, Wilde said, you know, life is a dream that keeps me from sleeping. And that's how I feel about posterity, which is the delusion of writers who really ought to lapse into unconsciousness.
It depends, too, what nationality of novel we're talking about. I mean, the novel in America is still extraordinarily strong. I feel this is because modernism never really reached America, and America is still engaged in the process of nation building, which is exactly the kind of thing that big amorphous, loose, baggy monster of a novel loves to address. Is you know, that's when the novel is important, and it's still very important in America. I mean, as we see, you know, novelists when we go to America, We stand in amazement before the centrality of novelists. Now, maybe it's to do with celebrity and everything else, but novelists are still important people in America, as they used to be in France, as they used to be in Italy, as they used to be here. They never were in Ireland, I can tell you, but they were here. But that is, you know, so it depends what, and who knows what's happening in China. I mean, I know nothing about Chinese fiction. It may be doing the most amazing things, and we may find out about that in 20 years' time when it starts to be translated. So the novel does work within the social structure. There's no doubt about that, I think. So, you know, we can't just talk about the novel as a one thing. It's disparate, and it does depend on where it's being written.
It's an interesting pattern that's already been established, that the novel follows political power. And I agree this can't go back very far, but it goes back to the 19th century and has continued since then. E.M. Forster said in 1927 the British novel fears the French novel and the German novel, but English poetry fears no man, he said. But he wrote his last novel around that time, in the mid-20s, and yet he lived on to 1979, by which time the center of gravity in the novel had crossed the Atlantic. Eerily obedient to the shift of power after the Second World War. So if the schedule is stuck to, then the Chinese novel will be what we're all thinking about in a generation's time.
I don't think the Chinese are notoriously insular. I mean, the interesting thing about the American novel is that it's a banjaxed imperial discourse. It's about both, I take John's point about nation building, but it's also about telling the rest of the world about the nation that is being built. And I'm not sure whether the Chinese writers of today will be quite so anxious to let that information. Yeah, there isn't the boosterism necessarily. I mean, what is notable about the post-war American novel is its sense of entitlement as a form, that it is entitled to have this. I'm not as convinced, even though I actually am American, I'm not as convinced a mid-Atlanticist as you are, Martin, and I'm not necessarily taken by that. I also would take issue with, I think that one of the things about the contemporary British or English novel, or archipelago novel, I suppose one should say, since John is here, is a term I favour, I think we should call it the archipelago, is that, people like it to be easy, and there's an enormous, we're in the midst of a continuous, everybody's keen to weigh into Finnegan's Wake, everybody's keen to sort of ditch those modernist excesses as if they were the sort of, what had happened after the revolution, how the Robespierre and his pals had gone mad and created this terrible kind of, words were being hauled up in tumbrils and executed in the most vile ways. In fact, in my view, the archipelago hasn't had enough modernism. On the contrary, the novel at the moment, if you look at the kind of novels that gain absolutely unrestrained praise and are accorded as being central to what's left of this previously central tradition, they often seem to me, and I can only speak for myself, to be like kind of chocolate box novels. They're like they're English heritage novels. They're novels that are preoccupied with enacting the ghost, the sort of revenant of what the idea is of what a novel of that kind should be. And I'm not sure that that's a living tradition. It's a novel with a plush rope around it. A stately novel.
You should stop reading book reviews, I think, Will.
I don't read them
I really think that you're falling into the notion that what's being reviewed well and what's being loved at the moment is what is going to last. That's never been the case. I love getting those old novels from the... It lasted right up into the 1930s, I think, where they always advertise books at the back. You buy a volume of Henry James or somebody, and at the back they advertise 12 other novels. Greta does, the greatest works of our time. All of them by people whose names are entirely forgotten.
Yes.
That time is the sieve. Time is it gets rid of all the stuff that... I mean, by this peculiar process that I certainly don't understand. I mean, why should it be that people in 30 years' time will know more about what's good and bad than people now? But somehow, if the thing lasts, it lasts.
Being remade by each era. So we sit here now, we are very much in 2007, and if we wish to discuss literature and the status of the novel, it's a 2007, not a 2037 or 67 discussion about it. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Inevitably, those discussions might be quite different. They might be quite... And the kinds of names that might be mentioned, I mean, some will be unassailable, but many won't.
Well, it depends. Are you talking... one of the odd things about getting the people who actually do it to come and talk about it is that we're, you know, in the belly of the beast. We're actually doing the thing day after day, this grimy job that we do that everybody thinks is wonderfully exciting. It's just, you know, drives us crackers. But we really can't talk about it with any objectivity. It's true that for the writer there are two books. There's a book you're working on, there's a book that's finished and it becomes, but you still don't know anything about it. I mean, we don't know anything about our own work. When I send one of my books into my publishers, I wait for the rejection slip still. You know, I think that they look at their nails and be terribly embarrassed and say, "John, we don't think this is very good." Instead of which they throw their hats in the air and say, "Oh, this is wonderful." So I don't know anything about how the public receives my work. And to go back to Martin's statement at the very beginning, which is, you know, sort of revolutionary statement to make in a meeting like this, a love affair with the reader. I suppose I'm with Will. I certainly think that they're getting confused here. The process of doing the thing one writes for oneself, there's no question about that. One does not write with an audience in view. I think if one did, the book would be a dreadful mishmash and a failure. But after that, you do have a certain amount of interest in who might read it and so on. So that, you know, we're caught in this strange bind that we can't really talk about literature or even fiction, that little corner of literature called fiction, with any objectivity, because we do it.
Well, except we draw implications from the past, and we wear a different hat. But far from thinking that that the novel is secure in its centrality, you know, I grew up, and as Will was too young to go through this time with the novel. But when I was started out in 1973, around the time John did, we remember very well this minority interest sphere, where you sent in your novel, it got reviewed, and that was that. No interviews, no parties, no book tours, no readings. That all the supererogatory stuff was not there. And I think what changed it in this country was the expansion of the media and the newspapers around 1980.
Yeah, but it's mere persiflage. I mean, you've seen the figures this week for the Man Booker shortlist this week, 120,000 copies in hardback of the 6 shortlisted titles have been sold, of which 90,000 are McEwan's Chesil Beach, which is, you know, I don't know whatever it is. It may be a very great book, but it doesn't look like a very demanding read to me. So, you know, you've got 30,000 sales. This is a country of 70 million people, all of whom, barring the children, are literate.
Well, but even the children. But I'm not talking about sales. I'm talking about the expansion of the personality of the writer. And this happened simply to fill the pages of these enormous newspapers that were having to be bench-pressed out of the newsagents, and they ran out of, you know, alcoholic movie stars, homosexual politicians, adulterous golfers and rapist boxers, and were reduced to writing about writers, simply to keep the machine going. I'm not talking about sales, I'm just talking about the presence of it all. And then suddenly the serious novel was on everyone's lips in a way it hadn't been.
So you're suggesting that's a positive?
Well, it was a sort of happy accident in a way, but I mean, but I can well imagine it returning to being. I think there will be popular books and books that sell a lot, but the literary novel, as I understand it, might well return to being a minority interest sphere, completely unfrightening to those who grew up with it being that way.
I think that it's slightly more than the media becoming, you know, finding a new subject to write about. I absolutely agree with you, that's true. But there is a little bit more to it. I think that in a post-religious age, people are looking about for a new priesthood. And it used to be the poets for some reason the poets have fallen out of fashion. As Mark said, when we started publishing, the poets were still in the ascendant, and that's only 30, 40 years ago. Now, novelists are being fixed on as people who can tell you how to live. This seems to me very dangerous. I think maybe Martin would welcome it. I find it very dangerous. I have a friend whose life is constantly in emotional chaos. She phones me up and says, John, what would I do? I'm in this dreadful affair with this person I've got. And I say, why are you asking me? He says, well, you're a novelist, you know about these things. I say, you're asking completely the wrong person. I can write about it, but I know nothing about it. That's a strange paradox. You know, I say to her, look, what do? I sit in my room day after day after day writing sentences. I don't go out and deal in the world that you deal in. So it's this maybe moves us on to something else, the cult of personality, the notion that because we produce these glittering objects, and let's face it, you know, some of the books we produce are beautiful, splendid things. And people look at us and say, if they had the patience to spend years and years doing this thing, they must have a knowledge that I would like to have, that I would like for this novelist to share with me. But we all have the experience that when you do a reading or a book signing, whatever, the people, you can see that disappointment coming into their eyes. And they're saying, you know, and I always want to say to them, the person that you're speaking to is not the person that wrote this book. The person who wrote this book is somebody else, and it's also you. You know, you wrote this book. A large part of the expectations and the fulfilled expectations that you have of this book came from you. So don't look to me, I'm not a priest.
Well, I think that people are in no doubt about who the modern priest substitutes are, and they're people who are enormously powerful. They belong to the establishment in this country that is the largest single employer in Britain. They belong to the institution that is never off the front page of any of the newspapers for more than a day, and the fate of which everybody is concerned about almost every living and breathing moment, which is the National Health Service. And they are doctors, and they are the contemporary priesthood. Writers are but a pale shadow of that. The reason people are interested in writers, I think, oddly, has very little to do with literature, and in more to do with what Martin said about the market economy, which is a bit of an illusion in its own right. But in an age that is predicated on the ideology of a market economy, the writer stands as like a coal miner in the forest of Dean who owns their own shaft. That is what appeals to people who are driven mad by post-Thatcherite economics. The only way to get out from under the corporate man is to have your own word mine. Now, people grasp that intuitively. They don't really want to write books when they go on creative writing courses. What they want is a coal mine. Because they understand if you can get the trick of it, that you need never answer to a boss again or punch a time clock or be involved in any of that, even if you are condemned to type for the rest of your life.
But are you not re-assimilated back into that economy precisely because of the literary industry and the demands that it makes on you now? So that it isn't, you end up not being as free, perhaps. As
I think writers have always been quite acutely aware of the, you know, a lot of writers of the commercial side of their work. You know, one thinks of F. Scott Fitzgerald browbeating his publisher over what blurbs had been written on the prospectus of Tender is the Night, or keeping a book in which he wrote down religiously what he got for every short story. I mean, you know, ask a coal miner in the forest of Dean whether they know the price of coal, you know, or how they're going to get it from, you know, or any small-scale producer. It's essential that you be involved in it. The problem for the fiction writer, if you're talking about the sort of book business, is what is happening with the stochastics of the industry at the, you know, the wholesale, the retail, and the publishing end of things and what's happening there. It's not so much, you know, what are my words worth? Most writers know what their words are worth at the going rate.
But would you mine a different seam if you thought this would there was a market for it? I'm not sure how far that metaphor will take us, because I think there's a sense in which I'm utterly indifferent to the market forces. I think that feels like writer's block to me, to sit down and have some other star to follow other than what you think the novel you're writing is trying to be, which is still mysterious to you. But the idea of, I'm sure you don't do this, Will. You may be just sort of brash talk. I'm sure you don't tailor what you're writing.
Not in the slightest. No. There's a disjunction between understanding what your words may be worth and tailoring the words to earn more. That's quite a different proposition. It would be impossible for me to do, though I do know of writers, and if you want to see me afterwards, I'll tell you who they are, who have been known to focus group and sort of test market their product on a little sort of, rather like the sort of new labour of fiction, but quite clearly they are not writers as you, I, or indeed anybody here would understand the term. I'm not really talking about that. I think it's quite possible, it's a sort of left-right brain thing. It's quite possible to be completely focused as a creative artist on doing what you have to do and at the same time understand equally perfectly what it's likely to get you.
But that's tough, isn't it? I mean, or otherwise. But I mean, there's nothing to be done about that. It's a very menial part of the,
which part of the brain is it?
left or right? But I mean, it's a very junior clerk in that department. I think that people think that there a great deal of calculation goes on about that. And, you know, the selection of the subject, the sort of sympathetic characters. And it does on the sort of pop level. To be indiscreet, I was staying in France, this is about 1980, and that very nice man, Ken Follett, had just sent his typescript of his next thriller into America. And it came back, and male characters have been changed to female characters, sympathetic characters have been changed to unsympathetic, and vice versa. Huge plot rearrangements. Now, no serious novelist is ever going to be in that position or ever have to think about anything like that. I mean, the minute you have this love affair with the reader, who is sort of you, or is a younger version of you, or an older version of you, but it is you as a student, as a sort of someone awakening to literature. The idea of, as you say, in American political circles, they actually wire up people, as if they're watching a pornographic film with a sort of Peter meter and a measure their blood flow when the politician is trying out his stump speech. For the novelist to go an inch down that road would be, you wouldn't be a novelist.
It seems to me that the trouble that people like the three writers here labor under, it's odd that the university organized three stylists. Good to have a Ken Follett here, maybe, who might talk something about the realities of life. The center of power has shifted. When I was young in the 60s, I would buy the Sunday Times and Sunday the Observer every week, and I would read Sarah Connolly and Raymond Mortimer and Philip Toynbee. These were the gods. And at those times, they had a weight in society. Now, they didn't, hundreds of thousands of people didn't read them, but a small, powerful elite read them, and that elite did have power in those days. That elite is still there, but it doesn't have power anymore. And that has all shifted to the pop culture, contradiction in terms. I happen to, I won't say I'm a friend of his, but an acquaintance of mine is Bono, the U2 fellow, And I had lunch with him a few weeks ago, and there was, you know, it was quite a large number of people. And Bono has developed this voice, which is, you know, it's pitched at the level, and it goes on and on, and it's absolutely unstoppable. And he's a nice guy. I like him. I mean, I really do. I'm not being patronizing. I do like him. I think he's,
yeah,
many ways a good thing. He's a good thing. But I kept listening to this voice, and I think, what? And I thought, it's the voice of the Cyril Connollys and Philip Toynbees from the 60s. It was that voice that everybody was going to listen to, and that was absolutely confident was going to be listened to. So the center of power has shifted away from us, and we're trying to grasp some of it back. And I think Martin is right. I think that the literary novel will become powerful again within a small number of people. It's time for us to go back into the catacombs. It won't be good for our children, you know, their school fees won't be paid next year, but I think it is time for it to go back to become a minority sport.
It's very difficult, though, to see a situation in which, I mean, I don't know whether it's true within Ireland, but it's very difficult to see a situation here in which the discourse of Britain, after all, a union that seems perpetually on the verge of breaking up at the moment, is going to start engaging with a discourse with itself, whether in an elite group or within a wider group, that's going to involve the novel as a primary means of enacting that discourse.
Well, maybe not the novel, but I think art will come back, because I think that there is a catastrophe coming, whether it's political, military, economic, you know, there is a big fall coming. After that, I think people will bethink themselves. The danger then will
so
be
an optimist.
The danger then will be that we will be looked to as priests, and we have to say we're not, we can't do that.
On that slightly apocalyptic note, I'm going to shift the balance of power again, which will still make you central as authors, and I'm going to open this up to the audience, who I hope have some questions. There should be a microphone somewhere. Is there? Yes, Ian's got a microphone. Thank you. If you can indicate if you would like to ask a question, please do ask questions, and please indicate who in particular you're directing your question at. Or indeed the whole panel.
Can I just say we do have a mic upstairs?
Oh, there's a mic upstairs as well for anyone who's sat up there. I don't know where it is, but someone holding it will make themselves clear. Thank you, man in the green shirt.
I will start because I feel I ought to hang my head in shame as I edit one of these amorphous, overlarge literary sections. And it's a question for all of you, whether or not you think they serve any sort of purpose in the literary culture. Please say yes.
Okay, so that was a question about literary sections and reviews,
yeah.
Is it?
Reviews and this sort of explosion in writing about books, interviewing authors, etc.
Okay, do they serve a purpose? Martin? You love the reviewer.
Well, I think you stop reading that after a while. I don't think... I don't think writers read any reviews of anything after a bit, except perhaps in the more highbrow papers. But you read essays in book review form, but I don't think you want the 800-word judgment is not something you're after. And also it begins, as you get older, it begins to look more futile. What you'd rather be reading is reviews of books that were published half a generation ago, you know, re-reviews of books, because...
They do that in The Guardian, I think.
Yeah, they do it,
they
a sort of feature, you know, 10 years back or something. But, you know, as John was saying earlier, your trust in any judge except Judge Time evaporates, and it looks like a lot of surface activity. I mean, I'm sure it does serve many. It's vital to the book trade, and I'm sure...
Can you start off on the books pages of The Statesman?
Yeah, but they were very different book pages, and I was 22. You know, it hardly spring that one on me. I'm sure it does, and I'm sure it creates a general interest. You know, I'd like to see proof that it does, and I was quite relieved to find out that the Harry Potter swell has not overflowed into anything else. So I can dislike Harry, and dislike Potter, and dislike everything else about it. It's not something that you've asked the wrong guys, really, about that.
I just thought I ought to defend.
Well, Will may feel differently.
Don't ask Will.
I don't know. I mean, Lisa, I mean, why do you raise this? I mean, perhaps the best thing ever said by a fictional character about the media is said by the multi-millionaire Hiram Potter in Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye, when he says to Philip Marlowe, a newspaper is an advertising vehicle predicated on its circulation, nothing more and nothing less. And that's what obtains. So of course, you know, that there is no invalidity about the pages that you edit, regarded as an advertising vehicle.
Well, I edited the books pages of the Irish Times for about 10 years. My ambitions were fairly low-key. I had two full pages. We never had any ads, so there were always full pages. And I ran it on the basis that I was running a bookshop, that there would be everything from children's books up to high art, high philosophy. Simply on the basis that I saw my job was to keep people interested in books and interested in reading. I was frequently discouraged, but every now and then, you know, I remember writing a review of Louis Benin's The Metaphysical Club. Actually, that was when I'd stopped being editor, but my successor, I wrote a long review of that book, which I thought was a wonderful book. I wrote the review about 9 months after the book had come out, but she ran a full page with a large photograph, and Louis Menand's book, I'm sure to his bafflement, became a bestseller in Ireland for about 4 weeks. I mean, they just couldn't keep them on the shelves. What people made of this book about the origins of pragmatism, American pragmatism, but, you know, it just shows that it can be done. You can propel a good book to the attention of the public. Now, you may sell 10 copies and only one of them will be read, but the one that's read might be read by somebody who wouldn't have read it if you hadn't done it. So yes, it's a bit back to Will's Coal Miner in the Forest of Dean. You know, you're chipping away and hoping to bring up not only a piece of coal but a diamond every now and then and to get it taken notice of. This is whistling in the wind because I don't read my own reviews. I still review, and I probably should stop it. I do have that lingering sense that this is a public duty. I think that good book reviewing is an honorable craft if it's done honestly and it's not puffing your friends or downing your enemies. If you do it as honestly as you can, then it's still a worthwhile thing. I think it's mainly for young people. You see, you're asking old guys. I know Will is not as old as I am. Nobody's as old as I am. But, you know, one does become jaded after a time. But I still remember vividly, as I said earlier, buying the Times and the Observer when I was in my teens and in my 20s. And I was vividly excited by the reviews that I was reading, that I was vividly excited by the whole notion of the literary venture. So it is useful, I think, for the young. We're having a good time elsewhere.
More questions? Come on, people have questions. Someone over at the back there. Sorry, thank you.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Schofield. This is sort of a leading question because I'm the editor of a website in Manchester Confidential, but are we at the great CD moment, or even the digital moment, where the book form is sort of disappearing in a little way? I mean, what do you think is the future of the actual print novel? Will it morph? Will it change? I mean, will it look differently? Are you waiting for a great technological leap, maybe, so the technological form will look more like a book? Where do you see the novel going?
Well, we'll be reading on that.
Yeah, I already said that I think that if you are a lover of books and words, then that gets going with such intimacy in adolescence that having some screen or something you can take, you can poke at on the beach, has you know, it will never be as intimate and will never recall those moments of intimacy with words that people who care about it went through. The more technologically minded.
I'm writing my latest book on a 1932 Imperial Good Companion typewriter. I'm a complete Luddite. I used to think when I was, my age is beginning to tell, but my cantankerousness is getting worse. And about 10 years ago, I did think that if they eliminated the flicker off screens, that there would be something kind of fabulous about having a thing this big that you could carry around and you could read Finnegan's Wake or Ken Follett, or maybe Finnegan's Wake on one side, Ken Follett on the other. But I'm over that. I'm over that. I just don't think it's got absolutely effle to do with it, really. I mean, it is the great beauty of the book as an analogue bit of technology, its portability, its no necessity for a power source, all of that. And as a great believer, along with John, in the coming population spike, I don't think, it's interesting that Lovelock thinks that all important human information should be put on non-computerized forms, because that's the real threat. All of that electronic stuff is going to just go, it's just going to short out. You can just forget that. No, I mean, I don't really think. When there was a sort of crossover period when Windows, not before Windows, when Hyperlink was launched by Macintosh, so 20 years ago now, when people started talking about the hypertext novel and how the kind of architecture of the novel is going to respond to that. Forget it. I remember being asked to do a consultancy by Philips, the electronics people, again about 20 years ago, about what was going to happen, because they were trying the first prototype computer games at that time. They just sort of moved beyond ping, and they were trying to get people who had an eye for narrative to see what would happen with this medium. And I said, the only thing, I looked at what they were doing, and I said, the only thing that's going to motivate people to fiddle around with toggles and screens is sex or death. Those are the only narratives that you can get in this medium. It's too simplistic. Because the interesting thing, of course, about the novel is that there isn't a user interface in that way at all. The idea that anybody wants to read Anna Karenina and just sort of say, what would it be like if she doesn't go off with Vronsky? I'll punch the non-Vronsky button and see how this one turns out. No, that is not going to happen. The whole experience of reading narrative is to abandon your operating capability in that way and surrender yourself to identification. So it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen at a technological level, and it's not going to happen at a conceptual level. And I don't care if you edit a website.
I just want to say one little thing. The book remains one of the most potent erotic objects that human beings have invented. I remember many years ago, I finally got a girl I was deeply in love with. I finally got her into bed, and I was opening her front, her blouse, and she said to me, you look exactly as if you're opening a book. That's exactly how you do it. And it felt the same.
Presumably somebody in Manchester tonight is going to say, you look exactly as if you're booting up a laptop.
Turning on a computer. Actually, I agree with you in a way. I agree with the points made there. I don't think the book will die straight away, and I hope not, because I agree with it. I mean, it's a lovely form. It's a gorgeous form. But I think we have to be aware that there might be ways it evolves, which you can't quite control. It may evolve in ways which you can't now expect. And I think from a very established readership that you've got here, people who will read the novel form, I think you have to look to the future that maybe things will slightly change. So to just put this bland statement down that the book's a sentimental, wonderful, warm object, let's keep it forever, I think that's maybe a bit short-termist. And there are ways of expressing art on the computer now, in many ways, that do work right now.
Okay, we're slightly short of time, so can we have one or two more questions if people have them, please? Yes, in the middle over here. Is Joe going in the right direction? Can you raise your hand, clearly?
Sorry. I'd like to address it to Will, specifically, because he's most likely to be controversial. But is the growth of the sort of amateurism of people wanting to learn to do Strictly Come Dancing, Strictly writing novels, whatever it is, is there a sort of pyramid-selling aspect to it, that you're creating all these novelists, but only like 1% of them can ever achieve anything? Is there a sort of purpose to these writing schools?
Well, there have been more, there's a book published every 40 seconds at the moment in the world.
Aren't they mainly just a book about cats and things like that?
Well, yeah, but a lot of them are fiction of one form or another, and whether or not you regard it as genre commercial fiction rather than being the high level of fictive art that these gentlemen and I aspire to is kind of neither here nor there. It represents something to somebody along those lines. And, you know, the shibboleth that is oft repeated is that everybody has a book in them. What they don't understand is that they're not the person who should be writing it. And there is a sense in which creative writing forces are self-perpetuating, because most the number of serious English language novelists living in the archipelago who can earn a living by their pen could be comfortably housed in that vestibule at the end of the church. Now, what are the rest going to do? And what they're going to do is teach people to write creatively, thus creating more people like them, who in turn will teach more people to write creatively. And that's just a sad fact. You know, people say, what is your advice to young writers? My advice to young writers is get a job.
Martin, what's your advice to young writers? Now that you've started, and we'll finish on that, perhaps.
The University of East Anglia has a stunning rate of publications per student. It strikes me as unreal that my opinion of writing would go down if you could teach it. But I think what you can do is have high standards of admission, and then you can, you know, there's only one school of writing, that of talent, and you can't teach that. Imagine having genius classes, you know.
Genius come dancing.
Yeah, I mean, self-evidently preposterous. But you can bring it along, and you can certainly teach craft. And I know that the 23-year-old me would love to have had a couple of hours with the 58-year-old me. I could have saved him so much time. I could have sorted him out on so many little hints and pointers.
But he wouldn't have listened. And that's why he's ended up as the 58-year-old. He would have told you to F off.
Well, I'd have listened if it was me. Yeah, you've got a point. But I wouldn't have gone to a class. That's true. It's all getting rather circular and sinister way. But I'm going to see. I just started today, and I'm going to see.
And on that note, I'll just remind everybody that our three authors are going to be signing books at the back in the vestibule. Become an air hostess.
After they've had a cigarette.
The exits are that way. And do please go and buy books, which will make Blackwells very happy, and they will sign them for you, which you will love to have, I'm sure.
They're going to stay here.
They're going to stay here, so buy books and then come this way.
You may come to the altar.
Yes, exactly. Do come to the altar. So it just remains to say thank you very much indeed to Martin Amis, John Banville, Will Self for their time. Thank you.